Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. 2 more hours of important programming with top guests on vital issues and, of course, the kind of information that you simply can't get in the mainstream. I say that all the time. I think people listening to this program are well aware of it. In the first hour, I've got David Swanson as my guest. I think a lot of you know who David is. For those who don't, let me give you a little background about him. He, in 2004, he was Denis Kucinich's press secretary. He's also been media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, communications coordinator for ACORN, and the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. He is co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org. He's the Washington director for Democrats.com. Oh, David, you've done so much. I think I need the rest of the program to tell listeners about all the things that you have been and that you're still involved with. They're all important. You deal in vital issues. You're right in the middle of it all the time. You do a lot of writing. You're one remarkable guy, and I'm delighted to have you on the program. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve, and we're delighted to get so much good writing from you, and we've got great articles from you posted at AfterDowningStreet.org, which I would argue is the mainstream. I don't let anybody tell you otherwise, but I know who you're talking about when you say that.
Oh, you know who I'm talking about. I like to think, David, that we are the real media, and those other guys are the fraudulent ones.
Yes. I refer to them as the corporate media, not the mainstream, because if you look at their own polls, the things they hate to talk about are actually very mainstream.
Oh, I can't disagree with that. I think the term mainstream is pretty much thrown around to refer to them, but you're absolutely right. We are the mainstream, and they are very definitely out of the mainstream. David, there's so much going on and so much to talk about. We've got a terrible financial/economic dilemma on our hands. I think it's quite serious. If you took a look at the article I sent you this morning, I had one person comment to me about it saying, "You have a way of really scaring me with the stuff that you write." The title I had on my article this morning was, with a question mark on the end, "Worse than the Great Depression." Well, I'm not in the forecasting business, so I certainly don't know. But we certainly have a mess, and we have a new administration coming in that will inherit this mess, that the one that has had things in their hands for the last 8 years, that you have done valiant work, David, trying to get rid of. And we all wish that we could get rid of them, even at this late stage. Impeach the Bush crowd. Bush and Cheney, to me, they're all guilty. I think you feel that way, too.
Well, maybe not everyone in Washington, but
no.
A great many. You know, Bush and Cheney could never have done what they've done without thousands of potential whistleblowers refraining from blowing the whistle, and without millions of Americans passively allowing this to happen. And that starts with 500 people in Congress passively allowing this to happen, and in some cases actively supporting the various crimes. Holding Bush and Cheney accountable, doesn't have to be through impeachment. I hope it is, and I hope it happens whether they're still in office or not. But the possibility of prosecution begins now when they leave office.
Oh, absolutely. Impeachment number one, prosecution number three, and by all of them, I really meant the ones that are most criminally involved with the Bush people. Let's take a break, David, and we can come right back into this. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with David Swanson. David, I think we'd both agree that crimes committed by the people who govern us are not unusual. This kind of activity goes back to the beginning of the country. I remember I was working on something this morning and looking at an old article I wrote, and I had a very lovely quote from George Washington. Absolutely raving comments, extremely racist about Native Americans, and calling them all kinds of outlandish names. And way back when he was commander of forces and as president, he sent his underlings, his generals, to slaughter Native American people to make way for settlers and It went on then, and I remember a line I used in an article way, way back when I first started running, that if this is what the father of our country did, what could we expect from the offspring? So it's continued ever since. But under George Bush, it really has gone to a new level. And I have been as outraged over the past 8 years as you have, and you've devoted to your whole being, to getting these criminals out of office.
Well, you know, I think you're right that this is a nation that has an ugly history as well as good things in its history, that's engaged in genocides, that's engaged in all sorts of outrageous crimes and destructive patterns of thought and social structure. But, you know, some of what makes the actions of the Bush and Cheney gang so outrageous are the advances we've made in establishing rules of law and international law and standards, and the blatant openness with which Bush, Cheney, and their associates have set aside the law and declared absolute presidential power. You know, George Washington was someone essentially offered the possibility of being a dictator who turned it down, who said, I want to put power in the Congress and serve as an executive, and did so. Not without flaws, not without outrageous crimes, but before the Bush-Cheney administration, I don't think we ever saw in American history the degree of disregard for congressional and judicial power and the open accumulation of all power in the executive branch, so-called, so that we now have a president who signs bills into law and writes notes announcing he will disregard and disobey those laws, who disregards and disobeys laws that predate him and declares his right to do so as absolute, inviolable, because he is the unitary executive and the commander-in-chief. You know, part of what disturbs me about this so-called bailout is that we've taken military levels of money, fortunes, the amount of money that many nations have as a national budget, and we've given it to the executive branch. Congress is supposed to have the power to raise and spend every dime. We've given the right to borrow and spend trillions, unaccountable, in secret, to the executive branch, to the White House, which now has the power of the purse, the power of war, all of the power to make laws and to end laws and to throw out treaties and to negotiate treaties. Big story today, you know, the last hurdle for a treaty with Iraq is the Iraqi parliament. And thank goodness it's a big hurdle, but that's only because the U.S. Senate is lying face down in the dirt, pretending it doesn't exist. You know, we've just never had this sort of attack on the Constitution and on the standards of law as they exist at this time in any previous administration. And no matter how good the policy changes are as we move into the next administration, and they may not be very good, it will do nothing to deter future administrations from doing what Bush and Cheney have done, or worse, unless there's some accountability.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And this administration, everything from trashing the Constitution, trashing international law, legitimizing, if that's a proper word to use, legitimizing the use of torture, disguising it in less harsh terms. Torture is torture, and you can't put lipstick on that. The Iraq agreement is only the latest. Imagine a country, the people supposedly running the country, agreeing to let a foreign power occupy it. Not a pleasant foreign force, an oppressive foreign force that bombs at will, that attacks neighboring countries at will, that frankly does any damn thing they please. And the existing government, even though it's hardly the most legitimate government, they simply have nothing to say about it. Imagine them going along with this. It's really unimaginable to me, David. But I suspect that they're gonna finagle this thing through the parliament and get it passed, the so-called status of forces agreement, a SOFA agreement, And of course, we have these with countries all over the world, 130 or 40 countries all over the world. And I just can't imagine why any one of them would want us to be there. Imagine if Germany wanted to build bases, and I'm saying a benign country like Germany, our friend, wanted to build bases all over the U.S. Imagine the uproar if that suggestion ever came out.
Well, I'm with you. You know, most of these SOFAs, these Standard of Forces Agreements, and above all, this one that's being negotiated with Iraq, are treaties. There's no other word for it. They are treaties. And then they are only not called treaties when seeking not to remind the United States Senate of its constitutional right to approve or reject all treaties. But this negotiation for this particular treaty between Bush and his puppet government in Iraq has been going on for many, many months, and the Iraqi parliament has been doing a much better job of representing both the Iraqi and the American people than our own Congress. And I still have strong hopes that the Iraqi parliament will reject this latest treaty. I think that's where the smart money is. But it's very interesting because the population in Iraq and in the United States, in both cases, overwhelming majority supports ending the occupation, getting all the American troops and mercenaries back in America. And the Iraqi media is publishing these SOFA agreements. Every new draft is published by an Iraqi newspaper. Americans have been learning about the process from activists who go and translate the Arabic versions and post them on websites. And so here we have the Iraqi media doing a better job than the U.S. media, the corporate media we were talking about, and we have the Iraqi government doing a better job than the U.S. government in terms of standing up for the people. And so by these sorts of key measures, we have already put in place in Iraq a better democracy than we have here in the United States. So by the sort of logic that's used to uphold this occupation, we ought to be ending it and requesting an occupation of Iraqi troops in the United States to give us our democracy. And yet these things are just sort of brushed over by the corporate media, which is now celebrating this agreement not as three more years of endless, ugly, deadly occupation, but an agreement to end it 3 years hence, hooray, and advertising this idea that the Iraqi parliament is the last hurdle and that it will be an easy hurdle, both of which are nonsense. The United States Senate ought to be the last hurdle.
David, what bothers me more than even this agreement is the fact that we have things going on in this country, obviously a new administration coming in, the terrible financial economic crisis, and it's almost as though the Iraq and the Afghan wars no longer exist. You don't get many reports about them in the corporate media, or the dominant media is a term I often use. You just don't get many reports about them, but there is tremendous loss of life going on every single day. Not only by people being killed through violence, but the terrible deprivation that the natives of these countries are going through, the illnesses they're contracting. I've seen stories about in Iraq, children literally starving to death on the streets, begging for anything people will give them so they can get some food to eat. This is the liberation we gave this country. People that can only yearn for the good old days under Saddam. They literally yearn for those good old days. And in some respects, they weren't bad. Saddam was a brute of a leader. There's no question about that. But the only people who had to worry, who worried about it were the ones who defied his will. Iraq was the most advanced of all Middle East countries, Arabic countries. And, of course, Iraq, for all practical purposes now, no longer exists. The cradle of civilization literally no longer exists. The country has been decimated. Of course, we're there, and not till 2011, David. I think we both know that this is. If they approve it, then this will just something that will go on, and then it will be extended. If you want to know what we plan in Iraq, just take a look at South Korea. We went there in the 1950s, and we haven't left yet, and there are no plans to leave. Japan, the same thing.
And then the Project for a New American Century, which was the headquarters of the effort pushing for this invasion for years before it happened, had disappeared prior to this recent U.S. election and is now back. Their website is back in existence, and they are back organized pushing to extend and launch new occupations. These forces will not go away, but that does not mean that we cannot defeat them. Does not mean that that there is some divine guarantee that this will go on for 50 more years. There are things we can do and must do to change course.
Oh, we have to do. Let's take a break and then come back and talk about the new administration coming in and the prospects that you see and the ones that I think I see. We'll take a break and come right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lenneman. I'm on with David Swanson. We take a break at the bottom of the hour again, David, and one more after that. But we've got a new administration coming in. You did a recent article on the Obama cabinet, good news and bad. I took a peek at it. The names you throw up there are certainly better than the array that we've seen in the past. You probably saw my article, Obama Mania, where a lot of the folks that are mentioned in Obama's transition team, his interim economic team, names that are thrown around for key spots, they're not the kind of people that look like will change the direction next year. But your thoughts on what you see?
Well, and we've seen more names come out since we wrote those articles. And
like Hillary Clinton.
Well, not yet, as far as I know, 100% confirmed as the appointee, and of course, theoretically, the United States Senate would still have to confirm all of these appointees, but Hillary Clinton is the most talked about candidate to be appointed for Secretary of State, which is fitting in that every single other name that's been put forward for appointments comes out of the Clinton White House. It's hard for many of us to recall exactly how horrendously awful and criminal we all thought the Clinton administration was before the Bush administration made it look so angelic by comparison. We talk about transformational change and a new direction and peace and justice, and yet we seem to be talking about returning to the Clinton administration, which was certainly many cuts above the Bush-Cheney administration, but this was, you know, these were the people who gave us a lot of this deregulation of Wall Street, who gave us this conglomeration of the media, who destroyed welfare, who gave us NAFTA and destroyed jobs, who, you know, did many, many things that we thought were awful up until we had the Bush regime to compare it to. So here we have, you know, Al Gore's chief of staff now becoming Joe Biden's chief of staff, Joe Biden himself, someone we might want to talk about. We have Bill Clinton's lawyer, Greg Craig, becoming Obama's lawyer. We have Pete Roos as a senior advisor. We have Rahm Emanuel as chief of staff with two deputy chiefs of staff straight out of the Clinton White House. It's, you know, you hear in the corporate media that what Obama is doing is reassuring the public that he's not a radical outsider but a good establishment boy. And the fact is that Obama and McCain both campaigned overwhelmingly against that idea. The public voted dramatically for change, not for establishment returns to people who've been stuck in Washington for decades. And Obama's swearing that his appointments will be about diversity, by which he means that he promises to include at least one Republican in his cabinet. He has yet to commit to including at least one person anywhere who opposed this war. Is it so? You know, nothing's done, and no policies are settled, but the appointments are disturbing, to say the least.
David, I really see the new administration coming in to be seamless from the Bush administration. Oh, there will be some things that won't be exactly the same, and the rhetoric may be calmer and a little bit different. One thing we'll both agree on, Obama, he certainly is an eloquent guy. I just wish the things coming out of his mouth were intended to serve the people and not the special interest behind him. I felt all along that he was a very safe candidate. He was picked by the same kinds of power interests, and when it looked as though he was the guy, then big money really lined up very heavily behind him, and I think no more so than the Wall Street money. They really poured an awful lot of money into his campaign. It is unimaginable that he will not serve them, and we're talking about people that got us into this crisis. And one comment I wanted to make earlier was that with what's going on now under Paulson, number one, I don't see it changing under Obama, but the U.S. Treasury has literally been privatized. Now, just imagine that. The Federal Reserve, of course, is a private banking cartel, and now the U.S. Treasury, the federal government, the U.S. Treasury has been privatized, and Wall Street is in charge of it. So either another Goldman Sachs figure will take it over after Paulson, or somebody who's just about the same. It could be a Paul Volcker or a Larry Summers. It's the same crowd. Volcker is an old-timer. I can't imagine why he'd want the job. He's in his 80s. And, I mean, does he want to be the guy to have to unravel this? Unless he thinks that if he could do anything to make it better, he'll get on history as a miracle worker. But if he fails, it might kill the old guy. I don't know whether his heart can stand up under this terrible crisis. But things will probably go on about the same. And the people who really run the country, the moneyed interests, will continue to run it. It's a very tough situation that we look forward to.
Well, I certainly agree with your last statement, but I think there is the possibility of changing things, and I think there is a slightly greater possibility of changing things with Obama, Biden than there would have been with McCain, Palin. So I think hear music.
We hear music. We'll take another break, David, and then come back, and I'll let you jump right back in.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. I'm on with David Swanson. David, let me just put in a couple of plugs and a quick comment, then you jump right back in again. For two wonderful websites, for yours after downingstreet.org, very easy to find with the important information that you post on the site every single day, and the site that's responsible for this program, globalresearch.ca, and my co-host and editor, Michelle Chosudovsky, a remarkable guy to say the least, and we share hosting duties. He's been teaching this semester, so I've been going full-time. He will come back when he's able, and maybe one day I'll get him to do a show together. I would love to have him as a guest, or if he wants, I'll be the guest and he can be the host to have a conversation on all these important subjects, David. The other comment, a very quick one, and then you come on back in. I never give up hope for change. To me, it's the greatest sin I know. If you give up hope, you lose everything. So we need always to keep it. We need to work for it. But it doesn't happen by itself. And I truly believe that the best chance for change is to make it percolate from the grassroots up. It's pretty tough to get it coming down from the top. The people with power don't give up any of it very easily. We have to convince them that they need to, which takes a lot of rumbling at the grassroots. It really is the way that all changes happen in this country throughout our history. Enough people got energized about things that they felt strongly enough about, and they brought about very important change. At times, the impossible. Ending slavery, my God. If we could end slavery that was institutionalized, at least in the South, you mean to say we can't get a smidgen of democracy? By God, we just don't. I see none of it around now. Why can't we get some of it? We've had better times in the past than we have now. Why can't we get some of it back? But we have to make it happen. David, you jump back.
Well, we can. We certainly can. And there are some encouraging things that are happening. And I'm extremely encouraged, you know, that my state of Virginia, for the first time in its history, voted for the better of the two choices for president, which is absolutely remarkable. North Carolina as well. This is encouraging. And the fact that millions of Americans believe in some way that they've elected an anti-war president is not necessarily a bad thing. It doesn't necessarily mean there are a bunch of suckers who've been had, because if you look at the details, he's not ever really been much of an anti-war guy. No, it can be useful if that movement is continued and people understand that it's their responsibility to push for what they think they just voted for, that's the deal you make when you elect a representative in a democratic country, is that they will take office and you will do your job of continuing to tell them what you want and what you don't want. And so Obama has his website, change.gov, where he's asking people to tell him what they want. So there's, you know, to get around the sort of attitude that's probably not that prevalent in people who listen to this show, but is fairly prevalent out there, that, you know, we must now step aside and let Obama do what he needs to do as a benevolent dictator, needs to be dealt with, and people need to understand that it's our role to insist on the change that we wanted to vote for. But even so, the most progressive voices out there now are telling people just that. Tell Obama what you want. Tell Obama to end this war. Tell Obama to end this bailout, and so on. If that's all we accomplish, we are dooming our nation to greater disasters in the not too distant future, because the only way we can have any sort of safety check against warmongering dictatorial power in this nation is to put power back where it was supposed to be, on Capitol Hill. And as a second step, of course, reform the Congress so that it actually represents us. But, you know, the fact that Congress is so lousy is no justification for allowing power to remain in the White House, which is infinitely more dangerous. And there are some hopeful signs. I think that, you know, the people Obama is looking at for the Department of Labor are infinitely better than what we've had, and indicate the possibility of building a labor movement, with the theoretical possibility that down the road that movement might fight for justice for the greater society, not just for labor unions. There is the possibility of ending torture, or at least ending the blatant, open, public policy of torture. And there is the possibility of ending these wars, but it will take a great deal of effort from all of us.
Oh, it really will, and it really worries me, some of the things that Obama talked about during the campaign, enlarging the military, sending more troops to Afghanistan. Zbigniew Brzezinski is one of his key foreign policy advisors. In his mind, the number one foreign target isn't Iraq. Iraq is a distraction. I think he's concerned about Afghanistan because it's in Central Asia. He's concerned about Russia, and I fear that I wrote an article talking about the new Cold War, reviving the Cold War again, and the idea that we will have another confrontation with Russia, I think, is a very serious possibility. And here we're encroaching right on their borders. They had some separation back in Cold War One, and here we are putting missiles in Poland and Czechoslovakia, right on their border. It has nothing to do with supposedly Iran attacking anybody. Iran doesn't plan to attack anybody. In their entire history since Persia became Iran, 1933, if I remember right, Iran never attacked anybody. They certainly defended themselves when they were attacked, but They're not planning to attack anyone. These missiles, of course, have nothing to do with defense. They have everything to do with offense. And they're pointed right at Russia. Russia has every right to be very concerned about this and very angry. And heaven knows what will happen as we get into the Obama administration. If he puts people in charge of foreign policy, Hillary Clinton worries me a lot, David. She is extremely hawkish. Somebody I quoted in one of my articles called her a war goddess. Will she be that way as Secretary of State? My goodness, I would hope not, but I'm fearful.
Well, I think she would be a disaster. She is a warmonger. She is the least likely to go out of her way for peace. You know, I mean, Iran took American hostages, and that's what offended American egos in Washington. And of course, they had done that out of fear coming out of the possibility that America might overthrow their ruler and put in a dictator, as America had done 20 years before. These treaties that we're pushing down the throats of the people of the Czech Republic and other nations for these so-called missile defense radars and bases are again treaties that the United States Senate is pretending it doesn't see, covering its eyes and ears and humming. But the Czech Republic, the people are overwhelmingly opposed, and their government may not accept these treaties. But you know, you're right. Russia has begun speaking strongly against these so-called missile defense bases, and to the point where the French president was going along with the criticism as of 2 days ago, and then reversed himself as of yesterday or today. But there is the possibility of blocking this stuff, even with the corporate media swearing that Obama now must support missile defense so that he's not seen as caving into Russia. This is the corporate media stirring up stupidity and warmongerism. Not stupidity on the level of Sarah Palin, who in an interview was just gleeful about the idea of a war with Russia. Just, oh sure, why not? Gee, what the heck? But stupidity nonetheless. And yet, the signs of something possibly better are there. You have Barney Frank, perhaps out of remorse over this bailout ripoff, talking about the need to cut the military budget. You have the Pentagon itself asking Obama to cut big weapon systems. You know, they've tried this before, and Congress has given them money they didn't even want. But they're talking about it.
The Washington Post, but they want more money, David.
Well,
they want an increase in their budget.
They want an increase, and Obama wants more troops. But there was a Pentagon board that a few days ago reported was advising Obama they need to cut some of these massive weapon systems, and there is an increasing number of Congress members talking about the obvious fact that we have to simply keep borrowing more money, or we have to cut everything useful. Or we have to cut the Pentagon, and that if we cut the Pentagon and these wars, we can fund everything we've ever dreamed of fairly easily. This is the kind of money we're talking about. I mean, the Washington Post, the Pentagon Post, yesterday, in an article about budget possibilities and priorities, was throwing around several times this need to cut the military budget. I'm not saying it will happen or that it'll be easy, but there's an opening for it that I haven't seen in years.
Well, I think people who listen to this program know that we spend more on the military than the rest of the world combined. And if you, I don't know if enough people realize that if you throw in all categories that relate to defense, homeland, and the so-called defense budget, we're spending well in excess of $1 trillion a year. And that doesn't include black budgets that the military has. It doesn't include the undisclosed budgets for CIA, for NSA. We've got 16 intelligence services. Can't imagine why we need 16, David, but we've got 16. I guess some of their budgets may be public, but a lot of this stuff is pretty secretive. It's not published, so people don't really know very much about it. But we're talking about, if you throw them all together, we're talking about tens of billions of dollars spent on this off-budget stuff. And then we've got the off-budget stuff for the supplementals for the two illegal wars going on. And these are two illegal wars of aggression that, of course, people to this program understand. We don't need to explain it to them. It's obscene. I'm with Chalmers Johnson, David, that this kind of spending has only one ending down the road, and that's a national bankruptcy. And, of course, it's intensified with all of the trillions that will end up being spent in the looting of the federal treasury to give it to the banksters. The banksters, the fraudsters is the word that I love to use all the time, who got us into this mess in the first place, and they're being rewarded for their crimes.
And it's not just coming out of the treasury as if we have it there. It's being borrowed, and it's being borrowed from foreign nations, which are going to understand that continuing to lend us money is lending us weapons. That's what we're spending our money on. And so that may begin to dry up at some point. But I think that you're right, that the danger is not just in all of this money going to killing and threatening, but it happening in secret with these massive secret budgets. One thing that's gone is the congressional power of the purse, so that Congress was completely aware for the past years that if they were to cut off the legal funding for the occupation of Iraq, the president would have continued it illegally. He has that kind of money at his disposal, unaccounted for, and so they would have been left with nothing other than having to do their jobs and impeach him. I mean, we saw Congressman Brad Sherman ask David Petraeus in a hearing in Congress, what would you do if we cut off the money and said end this thing and the president illegally kept it going anyway? You know, and Petraeus said, well, I don't know, I'll have to ask my lawyer. But the interesting thing was that the question was asked because Congress members understood. And so, you know, when we create these secret branches of government, they do all sorts of horrible things that are not part of their written agenda. You know, they assassinate and torture and so forth. But they also eliminate the power of the purse and give the president powers that you just cannot trust any human being with. So that is one of the major long-term changes that we need to make.
Oh, there's no question about it. And you've been associated with Dennis Kucinich, one of the few in the Congress who really has the backbone to have drawn up articles of impeachment, to have gone public on some of these important issues. And amazingly, David, once in a while, he even gets coverage in the press. Not a heck of a lot of it, but a little bit. And he's a courageous guy to do this kind of stuff. Now, just imagine if we had a few hundred Dennis Kuciniches in the Congress. Imagine the difference that would make.
Well, he's unique, and I don't know how we breed 500 more Dennis Kuciniches. I think the most likely way we get that to that point is to eliminate the three major problems with our Congress, those being the influence of the corporate media, which we've talked about, the control of money, this system of legalized bribery that has these people bought and paid for, which is what got us this so-called bailout, among many other things, and the influence of parties, the power of parties, which leads most Congress members to simply obeying their party leadership rather than their constituents. We have generally two voices on Capitol Hill plus a few Dennis Kuciniches. This is absolutely disastrous. It's something that people in George Washington's time knew was a danger that faced this republic, and we have pushed it to the limit now. So if we could control the money and the media and the parties, we might elect some people who wouldn't be exactly like Dennis Kucinich, but who would listen to their constituents the way that he does.
Oh, absolutely. We need a completely revamped method of electing our officials. We have a very, very corrupted electoral process. Just the fact that $1 or the amount of dollars that you have is the degree of influence that you have. So if I have a buck and you have a buck, David, and somebody has $1 million, then they have a million times the influence that we have. So we get the best democracy, as Greg Palast says, we get the best democracy money can buy. And it corrupts the whole process. Two parties dominate everything. Even members of their own party, like Dennis, get completely marginalized and shut out. And third-party candidates or independent candidates like Ralph Nader, Cynthia McKinney, they're ignored. Nader got about half of 1% of the votes, at least of the tabulation, I think, so far. I think that'll be about the final number. And Cynthia McKinney got about 3/10 of 1%, if I remember the numbers right. Well, that's outrageous. I mean, two people who would deserve to be elected were completely shut out. And it was, as Ralph Nader says, we had Twiddle-Dee and Twiddle-Dum, and we ended up with, take your pick, we ended up with either the D or the Dum. Let's take a break. I haven't given up hope, David. Let's take a break, and we'll come back, and this hour, as always, flies by. Welcome back to the News Hour. Steve Lemon, I'm on with David Swanson. David, I'm sure you get emails like the ones that pop into my inbox every now and then, the idea of George Bush committing the final supreme act of arrogance, pardoning himself.
Yes.
Oh, dear. It leaves me breathless just to think about it.
Well, it's not just that he might pardon himself, but he might pardon all sorts of subordinates, top officials on down, who engaged in crimes at his instruction, at his authorization, in response to his decrees and orders and statements that these crimes were now legal and permissible, and his specific instructions to engage in them. This is increasingly likely. There are voices on Capitol Hill and in the media pushing him for it, advising him to do this. And it is absolutely an abuse of power. It's impeachable. If he pardons himself, it's another public obstruction of justice. He can, at the very least, be charged with obstruction of justice. And there's no reason that a President Obama shouldn't overturn any such pardons as outside the realm of acceptable pardons, which is something that that Bush considered doing early on with Clinton's pardon of Mark Rich and chose not to, despite his lawyer's advice. I mean, when the pardon power was put in the Constitution, the idea was that the president would have mercy on specific individuals who had already been convicted of crimes and sentenced. Not that he would preemptively pardon anyone, which has now come to be accepted, and certainly not that he would pardon anyone of a crime he himself authorized or had anything to do with. In fact, both James Madison and George Mason, in arguments at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, argued that we needed impeachment in the Constitution because a president might at some point pardon or interfere with an investigation of crimes that he had something to do with. Well, this president has already done that in commuting the sentence of Scooter Libby for obstructing an investigation that was headed toward Bush and Cheney, and he's widely expected to pardon Libby, not just to have commuted his sentence. And it's absolutely outrageous. Congress should be standing up and saying that if you do this, we will impeach anyone you pardon. Will be impeached. The thing, and we will impeach you. But the thing is, it may be a blanket pardon. It may be a pardon of anyone who, for the good of the war on terror and so forth, was engaged in any of the following activities. And so there may not be a list of names, except for the list that we all already know of people who were involved in these crimes. And sadly, there's this incredible push from the Obama camp and others in Washington to move on, put it all behind us, don't look backwards, and so forth. And yet, a Justice Department's job is to look backwards in order to provide deterrence moving forward. And if this is allowed to go through, if we establish that a president can not only violate any laws he wants, but ensure the safety of those involved by pardoning them himself, then we will have no rule of law whatsoever years to come.
As you said earlier, it would set a precedent that other administrations could follow, the worst kind of precedent, that the President of the United States is above the law, so forget about the law. The President can do anything he wishes or she wishes. Oh, my goodness. The hour is gone. The hours fly by so fast, David. There never is enough time. We could go on easily for another hour. All I can do is thank you for coming on for a scintillating hour. We have to do this again.
I appreciate it, Steve. Thanks for your great work.
Oh, thank you, David, so much. Michael Parenti coming up in hour two. Stay tuned.